It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The oldest documented zoo in the world is the Vienna Zoo, founded as the Imperial Menagerie in 1752. The oldest zoo in the United States, the Philadelphia Zoo, dates back to 1874. Zoos have been a part of our culture for a very long time, but zoos have changed pretty dramatically in recent decades. This hour, we'll talk about the purpose of zoos, the impact they have on education and conservation, and how zoos may change in the future. We'd love to hear your thoughts this hour. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to start the hour right here in Iowa at Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. With me is Mark Vukovich. He is President and Chief Executive Officer of Blank Park Zoo. Hello, Mark.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Kevin Dries is also here, Director of Animal Care and Conservation at Blank Park Zoo. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. Good afternoon. Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And since I started with a little bit of history on zoos, let's do a little bit of history of Blank Park Zoo. Mark, the zoo opened way back in 1966, but it was a children's zoo at that point, right?
Yes, it was. The Myron Blank family gave the city of Des Moines $150,000 because they thought Des Moines was large enough community to have a zoo. And it started out as a children's zoo. A petting zoo, would be another term you would use during that time frame.
All right. And it remained a petting zoo for quite a while. The zoo closed in 1982. It reopened in 1986. And during the previous decade, the American Zoological Society was formed. Zoos had the opportunity to become accredited. So when the zoo reopened in 1986, it was with a very different idea in mind, right?
It was a zoological park where animals that would be displayed in a more native manner. There was much better animal care. The exhibits were larger. The holding was designed for each individual species, not a general holding that you would put an animal in. And at that point in time, the Blank Park Zoo became a member of AZA and has been accredited ever since.
All right. Now, if you visited a zoo in 1986 and you visit a zoo in 2017, things are going to look pretty radically different in spite of the fact that, you know, the Blank Park Zoo was accredited then. The standards have changed a lot over the years, haven't they?
The standards have become dramatically more difficult in regards to what you need to do to be accredited. A lot of it is in animal welfare and animal care. When the zoo was founded, we had no healthcare professionals on site in the way of vet techs or veterinarians. And today at the Blank Park Zoo, we have two full-time veterinarians, three full-time vet techs, a partnership with Iowa State University Veterinary College, where senior vet students rotate through on a basis. We're kind of like the Chicago Hope for Iowa State, where they can spend a month working with our vets on exotic animals, and then when they leave to practice medicine, they have exotic animal experience when they go out into the real world. So, matter of fact, today is a fine example. We've flown three doctors in from Miami that specialize in eyes on pedipeds, seals, sea lions, dolphins, etc., and we're doing a cataract removal on one of our sea lions today with a high-def camera into Iowa State, where 30 vet students at Iowa State will be watching the surgery and be able to actually communicate with the surgeons in Des Moines at our vet hospital fixing the eye on our sea lion.
All right. And Kevin, you've worked at Blank Park Zoo, for about 30 years now?
Yeah, that's right. When you talked about the zoo closing and reopening, that's when I came to Blank Park. And so, yeah, so the changes we're talking about is part of what I've, always championed to follow and meet and exceed the expectations of the AZA or the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
So give us some insight in the 30 years that you've been there, and I know you've advocated for a lot of the changes that have taken place. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of caring for animals at Blank Park Zoo, how the idea of habitat has changed, et cetera.
Okay. Well, I think some of the biggest changes would be seen, like Mark said, in animal welfare and the focus on that. And so compared to how we were operating in 1986 to 2017, really, if you're a zookeeper at the Blank Park Zoo, you're an animal trainer. And that was not necessarily the case in the beginning. And by an animal trainer, I don't mean, of course, to do tricks and whatnot, but you're part of a program that enhances the animal's ability to participate in its own health care, which we usually call husbandry training. And so our animals give voluntary weights. They will allow voluntary blood draws. And this is a whole process that starts with the zookeeper's relationship with the animal and basically the same kinds of techniques that you would use to train your dog, we use to train our animals. And we've achieved some our staff has achieved some amazing things through that.
And give me a specific example. Tell me about an animal and how they participate in this health check.
Awesome. Well, as you know, we had a famous birth last fall to Mani, our eastern black rhino,
yes.
a critically endangered species. So her mother, Ayana, came to us when she was about 2 years old. And through our talented large mammal team, they were able to start a training program as soon as Ayana got settled in. And so when it comes down to this pregnancy time, they do give weights, but she allowed not only voluntary blood draw. When I say voluntary, she comes up to the front and she will stand while the veterinarian is able to draw blood from from the inside of her leg. But even more than that, once we confirm pregnancy, because she would voluntarily stand for an anal ultrasound, and that's actually how we were able to establish pregnancy and monitor the development of the calf.
Wow. So she would just, there was no sedation needed. She would just allow her trainers to carry out whatever they needed to do, so they could tell what was going on, and obviously that reduces the amount of stress for the animal as well.
That is the whole purpose, and how it not only helps animal welfare by reducing stress, but we're better able to monitor the health of the animals when they participate in that, and so it's not a stressful event. And, I mean, I could go around the zoo, like the training things we've accomplished with the big cats and also with giraffe. We've had 4 or 5 giraffe for these last 30 years, but the giraffe now, the zookeepers can ask them to put any one of their 4 hooves up on a bench so that it can be manually trimmed, where years prior it would have involved a complete immobilization and knockdown in order to achieve what our keepers can do today.
How do you feel the habitats have changed in your time there?
The habitats, basically, in that same theme of better animal welfare, it usually means fewer animals in the same space and more appropriate social groups, no single animals if that's not the way that they would normally live. And there is a big emphasis on mixed species exhibits, and that it could be looked at as that's better for the animals, but it's also, meeting the expectations of the public, which is also part of this journey, part of this evolution, is that our visitors expect a different zoo. And so, it's actually the community that drives some of these improvements in the zoo.
You know, looking at zoo history and some of the ways that animals used to be kept, I mean, it was almost like caring for livestock with a lot of different species in the past, where there would be a small enclosure and, food and water and bedding, and that was about it. And some of the things that we saw because of that, we would see the habituated behaviors, like when you'd go to the zoo, you'd see the tiger pacing back and forth, doing the exact same thing over and over and over again, which was a sign of, boredom and really distress. So have you looked at some of those behaviors, some of those signs that the animals were unhappy and made changes based on that?
I would say that, stress or distress that animals feel is something that, is very important to people who care for animals in captivity. And the way at Blank Park, what we've, and like a lot of zoos, what we've developed is what we call an animal enrichment program, where we try to, mentally stimulate animals, give them activities to do. So obviously the training I was talking about, mm-hmm. Is things that fill their day.
It's intellectually stimulating.
There we go. Yes. And it allows them to exhibit some natural behaviors that they would in the wild. Now, that could just be seeking food. If we present their diets, not just in a pan at one time of the day, but hidden under burlap, through leaves, and they spend more of their time gathering food, which would, mimic a wild situation.
Let's talk a little bit about conservation. We'll talk a lot more about conservation later in the hour, but I know that that has been more of a recent emphasis at Blank Park Zoo to participate in conservation both in Iowa and internationally.
Right. So we can talk about the evolution of zoos in general, but then there's also the specific evolution about Blank Park Zoo. And, you know, in its history, yes, it did reopen in 86 as a credit zoo, but it also privatized in early 2000. And that gave just more freedom in how and what we tried to accomplish. And AZA has always been saying that the mission of a modern zoo is, you know, not only recreation and education, but conservation and research. And so as Blank Park Zoo matured and evolved, we have had the opportunity to get involved in conservation. And by conservation, I'm talking about field conservation or outside the walls of the zoo, how the zoo helps wildlife. And we have done that both locally and internationally. And, you know, it's the exciting part of what's happened at the zoo and what we want people to appreciate about what a modern zoo tries to accomplish.
And a modern zoo's mission has changed dramatically. You know, our mission statement used to be recreation, conservation, education, and obviously recreation was the bigger part of our mission 25, 30, 40 years ago. And now conservation, we're using the education and recreation to make people understand what's happening to the wildlife of the world, and hopefully they'll be part of making decisions that will help the wildlife from disappearing, as we know it's happening everywhere around the world.
So as people are coming into the zoo, it's not just to see the animals that you have at Blank Park Zoo, but to get a broader perspective on wildlife and conservation issues around the world.
Yeah, every exhibit since 2009, we've updated our interactives, where everything is to get a person to think about the animal in front of them and what's happening to that animal in the wild. If you go to our tiger lion exhibit, we actually talk about poaching, and we even have a radio that demonstrates poachers being found and the mission of the rangers to try to stop the poachers.
And we'll take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the purpose and future of zoos this hour with Mark Vukovich and Kevin Dries of Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
They're scritch, scritch, scratching, jumping around, and scritch, scritch, scratching, hanging by the long tail. And we can still be, we go to the
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about zoos, the purpose of zoos, how they've changed over the years, how they will continue to change, the impact they can have educationally and on conservation. We'd love to hear your thoughts as well. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Mark Vukovich. He is president and chief executive officer at Blank Park Zoo. Kevin Dries, director of animal care and conservation at Blank Park Zoo. We're going to broaden the conversation here in just a moment, but Mark, just before the break, I had to cut you off when we were talking about some of the changes you've made to help educate visitors to Blank Park Zoo and help them understand their role in conservation, even internationally. So you were talking about how when a visitor visits a specific kind of animal, they're not going to just learn about that animal and their biology and the habitat, but they're also going to learn more about some of the threats that they face around the world?
Yes, they are. We have every exhibit has the status of that animal's survivability from not endangered to critically endangered, and we try to talk about what's happening. For example, with our rhinos, you can actually, as you walk up to the rhino building, there's a camera that snaps your picture like a trail camera. Eastern black rhinos are very elusive in the way they track numbers and what's happening to them. They post trail cameras around an area, and then they come back and obviously see the see the pictures of the animals. So you can walk in and then see your picture, and we describe how that's how we track the rhinos in the wild. One of the other things we do is with our educational outreach, I think what's changed dramatically, the Blank Park Zoo today has four educators on the road somewhere in Iowa with a zoo mobile taking animals to a school that and will do a age-appropriate STEM science presentation about that animal and how it's affected in the wild. And that has really increased our range of the people we can affect from, because we were in 83 counties last year and talked to 30,000 school children. And I think all zoos have really developed that outreach program to take their message of conservation and what we're doing to the animals of the world out to the site and let those kids see it there.
And as I mentioned before, we're going to talk more about zoos and their role in conservation as the hour goes on. I want to bring Rob Shoemaker into the conversation. He's Vice President of Conservation and Life Sciences at the Indianapolis Zoological Society. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's focused much of his life work on orangutans. He spent 10 years in Iowa at the Great Ape Trust before heading off to Indianapolis, and he is here with us today. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Charity. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And beyond what I just mentioned, you have a long history in zoos. You also worked at the National Zoo earlier in your career, right?
I did. I've kind of grown up in the zoo community, and I'm very proud of that. It's a little surprising when I think about the fact that I've worked in the zoo community for over 30 years now. And I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. It's been a wonderful experience from beginning to end, and it really affirms my belief that looking back on at least the time I've been in zoos so far, it affirms my belief that zoos are more important today than they have ever been. I think zoos have an absolutely essential role to play, and the good work at places like Blank Park Zoo and Indianapolis Zoo, we have an awesome responsibility, and we carry that because we care deeply about the animals at our zoo. We care about their conservation in the wild, and we care very much about our visitors, and we love sharing that passion with them.
Why do you think zoos are more important now than ever before?
Well, I want to be optimistic, but also realistic. And one of the things that I think all of us recognize that work in the accredited zoo community, we're in a conservation crisis around the globe. Folks are referring to this as the sixth great mass extinction on our planet. There's no way to argue against the fact that many, many species are in incredible peril. You've talked about black rhinos. I think rhinos are a great example of a species that need much more attention, much more conservation action, but there's many, many species that fall on that list. The reality is that most people don't have the opportunity or the resources to travel around the globe to places like Africa or Australia or Central or South America and others to see wildlife in their native habitat. We have to find ways to share that with people so that we can engage them and enlighten them and empower them to take conservation action. And, you know, one of the criticisms that I hear is people say, well, you know, you can do that by really good videos or so many great documentaries that are on TV. Of course that's true, that those things are fantastic, and we love those. But they're not a real replacement for seeing an animal in person. And that's really what the role of zoos are today. We take spectacular care of our animals. We educate our visitors and inspire them to take conservation action, and we advance conservation on our own by providing field conservation support.
So there are many people who argue when it comes to the environment and the fact that so many children today spend so much of their time separate from the environment, so many of us do, is that children won't grow up to be people who protect the environment or care about the environment if they don't learn to love it. So that's what I hear you saying, that we won't take care of these species if we don't love them.
Well, I couldn't agree any more strongly with you, and in fact, you've said it a whole lot better than I did. The whole point is you have to care about something and love it if you want to help protect it into the future. And to make that point, you know, we can talk about all of the animals around the world. The same is true for things like monarch butterflies in our backyards or migratory songbirds or even the native wildlife that we enjoy so much. So here's a great way that I like to try and talk about connecting that. So we might, for example, at a zoo talk about macaws or parrots that come from Central and South America. And they're fantastic, and they're beautiful, and they're exciting, and they truly are wonderful, and we do want to conserve those, of course. But the thing that escapes many people is that when you preserve the habitat for those species, you're saving habitat for the migratory songbirds that share our backyards in the spring and summer. Because that's where those migratory songbirds are going. They're living in some of the same habitat with some of these birds that we think of very exotic. So it's all connected. And when we talk about conservation, it has just as much to do with our actions and our behaviors in our neighborhoods and our local communities as it does around the world.
Kevin, do you want to add anything to this as well? I mean, obviously, you've seen many visitors come and go to Blank Park Zoo over the years. What do you feel like people really get out of a visit to your zoo?
Well, certainly, I agree with everything that Rob is saying. I think that for those of us who dedicate their lives to improving the world for wildlife, you can call that love, you can call it a fascination, you can call it being intrigued by. And I think we, as people, we're looking for ways that we can help that cause, and one of those ways is to be involved with the zoo. And the zoo is a reflection of the community and the people that are in it, and it's that desire of a lot of people that finds an avenue through the zoo. And so really the simple act of visiting the zoo or being a member at the zoo actually helps support in the wild conservation. And I totally get what Rob's saying about the local and the connectedness. And here at Blank Park, we like to get involved with greater prairie chickens just as much as we like to get involved with, Giraffe Conservation Foundation or International, because, you got to take care of your own backyard as we look and think globally.
Well, and tell me just quickly a little bit about your history with the greater prairie chicken in Iowa, because this is a species that was basically entirely gone from Iowa, and now we do have a few prairie chickens, not a lot of prairie chickens in the state, but Blank Park was instrumental in making that happen.
Yeah, now this is a story I like to talk about, just because I am an Iowan. I did move out of the state to start my career in zoos, but came back. And so I grew up in Iowa and never saw a prairie chicken. And in reality, the greater prairie chicken is tied to the tallgrass prairie or the prairies more so than the bison. Everybody knows about the bison. The prairie chicken was kind of ignored. But anyways, in Iowa, just due to modern agricultural practices, the last prairie chicken was extirpated in Iowa in 1952. And that was after there were millions of greater prairie chickens all throughout Iowa, especially here in central Iowa. But the Iowa DNR did transport and move some birds in the 80s, but they never really took. And when the zoo started to look for a conservation project locally it could be involved with, in 2010 there was an estimated like maybe 30 greater prairie chickens down in southern Iowa around Mount Air, where there was still a lot of cattle grazing. And the zoo started funding a technician that could do a habitat survey, and in the end, there it was determined a small population of prairie chickens could exist there. The Iowa DNR, we partnered with Missouri Fish and Game, and over 5 years, we translocated 100 prairie chickens from viable populations in Nebraska and released them in southern Iowa and northern Missouri, and today there is a population of prairie chickens. It'll always be probably managed, but there is about 70,000 acres that's prairie chicken appropriate habitat between southern Iowa and Missouri. Sometimes people like to ask, well, how do you catch a prairie chicken? And, you know, it's actually kind of easier than you might think.
Which is part of the reason that they were extirpated in the first place.
There we go. Early farmers, that was kind of what they did in the winter, was trap prairie chickens to send to the big cities as a food source. And that was, you know, unregulated harvest of greater prairie chickens is one of their demises.
Well, and Kevin, I took my children, my Iowan children, down to Kellerton to see prairie chickens for the very first time in my life last spring. So that was an exciting moment. But, you know, most people just don't care about prairie chickens. I mean, there are these species that kind of go under the radar. And Rob, you were mentioning earlier, you know, that maybe the scarlet macaw, that's a kind of a charismatic creature that people care about easily. Do we need to depend on people's connection with what my good friend Jim Pease likes to call charismatic megafauna to get people to care enough to conserve habitat around the world, Rob?
Well, I take your point, and I don't apologize at all for the idea that if people come in and they're excited and they're attracted to some really spectacular species that's exotic and unusual, that's great, because we love to educate and we love to talk about that species. But then we're always ready to kind of tie that back into a conservation story for that species or a local species. So I don't think that there's wrong with people being excited and interested with the exotic, as long as we remember that that's a great opportunity then to tie that back to other conservation stories.
And I'd like to add what Rob said earlier, the physical presence of zoos and the animals in zoos is what causes the connection. We've been involved in rhino conservation for the 5 years we've had the mother and father of our baby rhino. It took the physical presence of that baby to explode the support for conservation of rhinos in Iowa. We had millions of hits on our website. We had our Facebook fan base quadrupled. Our donations
for
conservation.
People everywhere are obsessed with baby rhino videos.
And it took the presence of the rhino, which would not have happened without a zoo in Des Moines, Iowa, being able to breed rhinos, to cause that excitement and cause that engagement of the public.
Well, and remind us a little bit. I mean, this is a critically endangered species. How did eastern black rhinos come to Blank Park Zoo?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked. The Zoo Association operates almost on a communal basis. And 5 years ago, we were hoping to, as we grew the zoo, to add an iconic species that was endangered that we might be able to help it get better. And we call the Zoo Association and say, here's the plans for our rhino building. If we build this expensive building, will you provide us rhinos? They decided that with our history, we've been accredited, we've been involved in a lot of AZA business ventures, we've helped with other projects, we've done a really great job with small animal endangered breeding of birds and other things, and they said, yes, we will provide you with rhinos. 90 or 120 days out, we call and say our building's coming together, and there's a SSP, Species Survival Coordinator, for each species in captivity in zoos. And that person tracks all the eastern black rhinos that are in zoos in North America. She has the genetic background of those animals dating to when they were brought to this country 50, 75, 100 years ago. And she knows where the babies are. And she says, there's a baby in Miami, a female that's 18 months old. There's a male in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We're going to provide you with those two animals. And we hope you get them together and they fall in love and they breed as soon as possible. We bring those animals in. we engage them with each other. They're solitary animals, so it's a long process for them to get together. We put them together, and in the first breeding cycle, we were successful and have this baby rhino that is now in our possession. When she gets to be 18 months, that rhino will go to another zoo and mate with another male rhino, and everybody in the zoo community from Indianapolis to Blank Park to a small zoo in Arizona that's accredited is in it for the good of the species. And those animals will be moved around to cause the greatest genetic diversity you can have and to help the species survive. So that's how it works, and we will be very happy to provide our baby girl to someone else to keep that species survival plan in motion.
Well, and there's a lot more to talk about here about endangered species being bred in captivity and what that actually does for the species in the wild or does not do for the species in the wild. And we will talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to take another break here. With me this hour, Mark Vukovic. He is President and Chief Executive Officer at Blank Park Zoo. Kevin Dreese is Director of Animal Care and Conservation at Blank Park Zoo. Rob Shoemaker is Vice President of Conservation and Life Sciences at the Indianapolis Zoological Society. He's an evolutionary biologist who's focused much of his life's work on orangutans. We'll talk to him about his work in a little while as well. We'd also love to hear from you. Why do you go visit the zoo? Maybe you've avoided zoos. Why is that? What do you feel their purpose is in our society? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Maintaining the very high metabolism rate there. But you're reminded that it once was there.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about zoos, the purpose of zoos, how that's changed over the years, what zoos will be like in the future, how they're continuing to change, and the role they can play in education and conservation. You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions, your observations. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Mark Vukovic. He is president and CEO at Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Kevin Dreese, director of animal care and conservation at Blank Park Zoo. Rob Shoemaker, vice president of conservation and life sciences at the Indianapolis Zoological Society. And just before the break, we were talking about the tremendous success that Blank Park Zoo has had in breeding a pair of eastern black rhinos and an offspring that has been produced. And that's been very exciting for a lot of people. And Kevin, I'd love to hear your comment. You know, this is one eastern black rhino and that has been born, and she's living in captivity, and she'll spend her life in captivity. What does that mean to the future of the species?
Yeah, that's the question. You know, Rob is the one who mentioned about the current wildlife crisis that we're going through, and because we have the rhino, I have a few little numbers about that. And for black rhinos, of which there are several subspecies, and ours is in particular an eastern black. But anyways, in 1970, which for many of us, that's not, out of our memory, it was estimated there were 65,000 black rhinos in all of Africa. And today there's only 5,000 estimated. And of the eastern black, which Tumani is, there is only about 800. And so there is a crisis going on. That was a 96% decrease in black rhinos since 1970, and So when we think there's less than 800 or so in the wild, and in captivity, talking about European zoos and zoos in the United States, there's about 400. So as the number of wild goes down, probably this captive population, which as Mark was talking about, the species survival plans, where they you know, breed for genetic diversity and it's going to become important in ways that we maybe don't know yet as we talk about the future of zoos, because really there is no wild, or basically it's just the level of human involvement. And so, you know, even in Africa with wildlife parks, there are no true wild places left. They're all affected by people and usually managed, even if it's in like a park system.
And Rob, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, because I know many zoos around the world are engaged in breeding endangered species in the hope that they can help preserve these species for the future. But a life in captivity is very different than a life in the wild. What are your thoughts about what this does?
Well, you know, you're right that when you talk about rhinos, I don't think it's inaccurate to say that the biggest difference between a life in a zoo versus in the wild is that you're safe. I'm not sure there are any rhinos in the wild right now that are really safe, because the pressures are so extreme. So, you know, when I think about that question of what does an individual, and it could be a baby rhino or it could be any number of things, any number of animals, what does that one individual or group of individuals do to promote the conservation of that species in the wild? And I think there's two big reasons. Number one, in some extreme cases, and I think black rhinos are a fair example, that is protecting, that's creating an assurance population. We want to make sure that there are populations that'll persist into the future. And that's harking back a little bit to, you know, the history of zoos when zoos were talked about as kind of like a Noah's Ark. I don't think that's really the right model, but I think it's fair to say for some species that does matter. And in some extreme cases, another example is like golden lion tamarins or black-footed ferrets, they would be gone in the wild if it wasn't for zoos creating those assurance populations and then eventually reintroducing them or supplementing populations in the wild. So that's the first thing. But the other thing that's very clear is that we inspire people to advance conservation through their own actions. And that can be changing their behaviors, or it can be supporting conservation efforts through an organization that they trust. It could be their local zoo who's involved in some important conservation work, or it could be some other conservation organization. So I genuinely think that these individuals, and again, individual matters. People are getting to know individual animals, not just a black rhino or a gorilla or a tamarin. They know them by name. They know those individuals. They care about them deeply, and they form a connection with them. And that's fair and legitimate. And I think that's a terrific thing when it happens. And there's no doubt that legitimate conservation actions follow that, and legitimate changes in attitude that benefit those species in the wild. It's absolutely the end result of what we're talking about.
Well, and I think it should be pointed out as well that it's a testament to the care that the animals are receiving that they actually breed in captivity, because zoos have worked very hard for many, many, many decades to try to get animals to breed in captivity, and there are some that just haven't. And, of course, the world watched the last passenger pigeon die in a zoo. There was a collection of passenger pigeons that did not breed in captivity. That was a long time ago, of course. But, you know, Kevin, the fact that you successfully bred and produced an offspring of eastern black rhino, and that says a lot about Blank Park Zoo, doesn't it?
It does. It means that all the factors, you know, came together. And we have, you know, across the zoo, we could look at those things when we reproduce even the different social structures of Chilean flamingos. You know, to be successful with those in captivity, it means that there was a good understanding of their social systems and what their needs are, and certainly diet and health, all that comes together. And it does show the commitment of the people that work in zoos, that they do want, you know, the best that they can for their animals.
And I do want to get to the phones here. We've got a number of people who want to participate in the conversation. You can join us as well, 866-780-9100. Eric is on the line in Des Moines. Oh, Eric is not on the line in Des Moines, although he had a question that I'm sure a lot of people do wonder about. Mike, and I'll let you and Kevin address this. He says, I've always wondered what would happen if a large animal escaped. And we saw maybe not a large animal, but we've seen some red pandas escape recently in zoos around the country, and there are occasional escapes. What kind of safeguards do you have in place at Blank Park Zoo?
Well, here's the good part about, you know, we haven't talked that much about the AZA or the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, but part of that being accredited is that all your operations are reviewed. And part of that is the safety aspects of your zoo, both, you know, animal enclosures, but also, you know, we conduct dangerous animal escape drills. And I'm sure that that Rob does as well. You know, that's part of being an accredited zoo, that you plan for those kinds of things. And so basically, we reenact scenarios, kind of like if you imagine when you have the, you know, the fire drills at a school and everybody goes out and has these things to play. We, you know, all zoos have perimeter fences, and so gates are closed, and emergency equipment is brought together to sort of address that. And so that's one thing about the AZA. If it's an accredited zoo, know that those kinds of things are oversaw by an organization. And in the United States, there's only 232 AZA-accredited zoos. And so it's sort of a stamp of approval that they meet those kind of criteria.
All right. And you said 232 accredited zoos. And there are also, I'm sure, animal collections, menageries that don't meet those accreditation standards.
Right. Yeah. One thing, in order to have non-agricultural animals and be open to the public, you need a USDA exhibitor's permit. And so you are under federal regulations to meet certain things. And it's my understanding that there's about 2,500 places in the United States that have a USDA exhibitor's permit. And so when we talk about there's only 232 that voluntarily join an organization that is going to require continual improvement on all aspects, veterinary care, your conservation efforts, all that, you know, rest assured that, you know, it's the best of the best.
Let's go back to the phones. Fred is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Fred.
This is Ed from Davenport.
Oh, Ed. Hi, Ed.
Yes, you just answered some of my question that I had there. I appreciate the importance of zoos for education and conservation. And I didn't know the number of zoos. That was informative, but I can't imagine how. I think we should make a national goal even to reduce the number of zoos. I've seen a lot of zoos that are just inadequate, and they don't really think about the. Yeah.
So
animals well.
All right, you'd like to see fewer zoos but more resources focused into those fewer zoos for the care of animals. I mean, Rob, I can see the point to what Fred is saying. Of course, when you talk about education, access to a zoo is pretty important, right?
I think so, but I also think Ed's right. I think that we don't need any zoos that don't have incredibly high standards. What we need are zoos that take spectacular care of the animals that they have. And that fits very neatly with my own philosophy, and it's something that we talk about here in Indianapolis. We are not trying to say we have the most of this or you know, the largest collection of this or that. What we want to say and what we work towards is that we want to do the very best job we can with a smaller number of species. I actually think that's the trend that zoos are focused on going into the future. A lot more specialization, a lot for example, larger groups of social living animals rather than a smaller number, creating really natural social groupings, really good quality environments for those individual groups, and really specializing in that way. So I think that's what we need more than anything else. I think that's where the zoo community has started to move and where it's moving into the future. And I would rather have when you ask about people having the opportunity to come for an educational experience, I want them to come and have a spectacular educational experience that leaves them feeling good and energized and inspired. That's really our goal.
And, Rob, before we run out of time, we could spend and have in the past spend hours talking about the work that you've done with primates, with orangutans, studying them in captivity and their ability to communicate through computers and all kinds of amazing things. A lot of research is conducted about different species in zoos. And of course, that's very different than the kind of research you can do studying a species in the wild. But why do you think it's important to have access to these animals in captivity to be able to study them and understand them better?
You know, it's such a great question, and I love the suggestion that there might be an opportunity to have a longer conversation about this at some point. But, you know, here's the thing. I think the answer to that question depends on the species you're talking about. There may be species where there's the opportunity to learn from them, to better care for them from a medical perspective, for example, and that may even transfer to help managing populations in the wild. When you mention great apes, I think there's a little bit of a different twist on that. And in brief, you know, great ape brains are really special. They are best at learning and problem solving, and that's what great apes do the best. So when they live in a zoo setting, they have to have opportunities to learn and problem solve, in addition to all the other good things that happen for zoos and happen for apes in a zoo with enrichment and training and so on. So the very best way I know that you can provide opportunities for learning and problem solving for great apes are in cognitive tasks, frequently computer-based. And those change over time, so they keep the apes well engaged and well interested. So in that case, you're advancing the welfare of the apes, you're advancing the science, and as people watch apes engage in those types of activities, they are drawn to them, they are compelled to care more about them, and that turns into a really positive attitudinal change that makes them care more about apes in zoos and the conservation of apes in the wild.
And we just have 2 minutes left, but I'd love to get a very brief prediction about the future. Where do you see zoos going? Rob, I'll let you go first.
I think zoos are going to continue to specialize. They're going to become centers of excellence for individual species, centers for education, centers for animal welfare, and centers for conservation.
Rob Shoemaker, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Rob Shoemaker, Vice President of Conservation and Life Sciences at the Indianapolis Zoological Society. Kevin Dries, what do you think the future of zoos look like, and maybe the future of Blank Park in particular?
Well, I think that the zoo, being a conservation organization, is where it can provide the world the best help with the wildlife crisis that's happening. So I think that I'd like to think the zoo is going to be a conservation organization with a very awesome group of visual aids, which are the well-cared for animals.
And Mark, you want to add anything to that?
Well, I think the captive population in the future will provide a whole bunch of genetic matter that we can use. There's already the frozen zoo where San Diego and Cincinnati and Omaha have over 1,000 species, stem cells, eggs, sperm on site. And as our science advances, being able to use the captive population and save those that genetic matter where they can use it later to produce live animals will be the what will happen.
All right. So you see a lot more emphasis on conservation and dealing with the global crisis that's really facing wildlife everywhere.
And then can I say one more thing?
Sure.
My favorite ending quote when I speak is National Geographic, October of 2016, stated, "As the wild shrinks, zoos are increasingly being looked at as modern-day arks, the last refuge against the rising tide of extinction." And I think that's the message we need to understand. That's why zoos are here.
Well, Mark Vukovic, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Mark Vukovic is President and Chief Executive Officer at Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Kevin Dries, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Kevin Dries, Director of Animal Care and Conservation at Blank Park Zoo. We've been talking about the purpose and the future of zoos this hour. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.
Someone told me it's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it. I do believe it's true. It's a light and tumble journey from the east side to the park.